to Tokyo Game Life, a Tokyo-based video game podcast focusing on Nintendo and gaming culture in Japan's capital. Your host Mono here to bring you a slice of gaming life from Tokyo. Here's your Tokyo update. It's still hot. There's some earthquakes, some typhoons, you know, life is normal. There are new ice cream flavors at the konbini, so it balances out. This episode's feature is different from the rest, as I'm going to highlight a Japanese gaming franchise that isn't as well known in the West. I'm talking about the ColdCept series with Andy Mann, the founder of ColdCept Central, aka the number one resource for the series in English. We chat about the history of the series, all the amazing artists who have contributed to the franchise, its unique relationship with Nintendo, the future of ColdCept, and much more. In the game section, I'm digging into Kirby 64 and Overcooked 1 and 2. A random mix of games, but there's a lot of fun things to talk about. And in the news, I'll run down the biggest stories in the Japanese game sphere and might introduce an entirely new section dedicated to Yuji Naka. Let's jump right into our feature on the ColdCept series with Andy Mann. This episode's feature is about the mostly Japan-only series ColdCept. It's a unique franchise with a long history, but still flies under the radar for even hardcore fans of Japanese games. I'm no expert, but fortunately I know someone who is. So guest, please introduce yourself.
Hi, my name's Andy. Online I go as Andy Mann. It's a nickname I've had since I was in seventh grade. I am the founder and admin of ColdCept Central, which is the largest community site for the card and board game video series ColdCept. We've been online since the middle of 2008. That's a pretty long time for a video game website.
Thanks for joining me today. Well, the most obvious starting point, what is ColdCept?
ColdCept I've heard described as Magic the Gathering meets Monopoly, sort of mashed up. Honestly, I feel like it's more addictive than either one of those, no disrespect to either game.
How did you first discover the series, and what made you really connect with it?
Well, the first ColdCept game that came to the U.S. was called ColdCept 2 in Japan. Here it was just called just plain ColdCept on the Sony PlayStation 2. I actually ran across it the day it came out here and bought it and played one match and for some odd reason put it on the shelf and didn't play it again until the demo for ColdCept Saga on the 360 came out in 2007.
Let's dive a bit more into the mechanics. Like you said earlier, it's a board game mixed with a card game, kind of like Magic the Gathering fused with Monopoly. But how does the gameplay differentiate itself from that comparison?
In terms of a board game, you roll dice, and then your character on the map, or the board, whichever you prefer, moves based on, you know, what dice you roll, what dice number, and depending on where you land, you can do a variety of actions, such as summoning a creature or engaging in battle with another player, landing on special spaces such as a fortune teller or a shrine, that sort of thing. And you draw at least one card every turn, and you can play those to do a variety of things. There's creature cards, item cards that you use in battle, and then spells that you can use at the beginning of your turn.
What can you tell us about Omiyasoft, the developer of the franchise?
Well, by their own website, they are a nomadic software developer, meaning that they work with a variety of publishers. Currently, the last three games that they've released have all been published by Nintendo in Japan, but they have worked with Sega, NEC, they've worked with Namco, they've worked with Nipponichi software, and they are not tied to one platform. They've been on the Sega Saturn, they've been on the PlayStation 2, the Nintendo DS, the 3DS, the Sega Dreamcast, and the Xbox 360. They've been all over.
Yes, the series is very platform agnostic. Like you mentioned earlier, it's appeared on Sega, PlayStation, Xbox, and Nintendo hardware. Why do you think it often switches platforms?
I feel like they make it for whatever platform they feel is the best fit at that moment. I kind of feel like they tend to predict a little bit what is going to be the dominant platform at the time, and they haven't always gotten it right. For example, the Sega Saturn, when the series first came out. Mm. But they get it right more often than not, I think.
In addition to hopping platforms, it also has a very sporadic Western release. One for the PS2, one for 360, and the most recent game on 3DS are the only ones to have official English translation. Why do you think there's such an up and down when it comes to localizing this series?
Honestly, that has baffled me throughout, because Cultacept has English audio in Japan, so localizing it into English is mostly a matter of changing the text to English, and you might be aware that Cultacept DS has a fan translation into English that basically a bunch of passionate gamers translated it themselves. So it's not hard. But yeah, I don't really have a solid answer for that. I was really hoping that Cultacept DS would come to the West, especially considering it was not even 4 months or so after Cultacept Saga arrived here. You would think they would have struck while the iron was hot.
Yes, I was surprised when playing it. Like, there is quite a lot of voice acting. Even all the card names have an English voice.
Yeah, they certainly do. And the names of all the cards are in English in the text as well. You usually have to hit one of the shoulder buttons to see that. But yeah, it's most of the way localized already, so it's a little confusing.
The most recent entry in the franchise was 2016's Cultacept Revolt for 3DS, which also got an English release in 2017. How does that game stack up amongst the others in the franchise?
It's a pretty big departure from the earlier ones. Fundamentally, it's, you know, the same Cultacept that we've known since 97. But instead of now, the way you used to do your turn was if you walked past one of your creatures, you could use its abilities that turn. They've gone to what they call a fatigue-based system now, which some creatures are never fatigued. Some creatures become unfatigued when you complete a lap. Then they'll all, I remember in the Japanese release of Revolt, they referred to it as standing or down, which means that you can basically use abilities and creature moves wherever you are on the map. Your location on the map in relation to the creatures doesn't really matter in Revolt. And of course, there's a lot of other little things that they've added and changed as well, such as a uniform die to roll on every map, where the previous games had a die unique to each map.
I've been playing it recently, and this is my first real experience with the franchise. It can be intimidating at first, since there are a lot of numbers, and when it comes to deck building games, the question is always, oh, what cards are good, what cards are bad? But I think the game does a good job in explaining what you can do and when to do it, like when to level up lands, when to invade, and so on. Would you say that Revolt is more newcomer-friendly compared to past games?
Revolt is by far the most newcomer-friendly in the series, to the extent that they added an entire segment of a tutorial where you were basically thrown right in the earlier games, and it would give you some pointers, but it was doing it while you were playing the main game. So yeah, you started at a great time in the series. Cultacept Revolt holds your hand a little better than what the earlier games did.
What about for hardcore Cultacept fans? Is Revolt considered to be the best one, or is it sort of some weird deviation?
Honestly, it's just different. I do know a fair number of the veteran players kind of wished that they could have dove right into the deep end of the pool, as it were, rather than have to go through the tutorial. And another thing that Revolt does is locks some of the cards away until you've progressed through the story mode to an extent. But I can't honestly say it's better or worse than any of the previous games. It's just different because of the gameplay mechanics. I do know that it is a much more aggressive game, because the game currency, they call it G, which sometimes we refer to that as magic power, is much more plentiful in Cultacept Revolt than in the past games.
Another thing that stuck out is the card art. I was amazed at how many high-profile Japanese artists contributed to the game. Just a few of them are Akiman, Katsuya Tarada, Mitsuhiro Arita, Ippei Soeda, and of course, Kinu Nishimura did the character art. What's so special about the art of Cultacept?
Well, I feel that right from the very beginning of the series, Omayasoft embraced the varied mythology that the game draws from. That gave them the opportunity to enlist the help of many, many very talented artists. The cards, in my opinion, are one of the aspects of the game that really shines. As you've probably noticed on Cultacept Central, the fan site that I run, we have galleries for each game that show all the cards, but we also have things like our wallpaper gallery and that, where it's you can basically just go and admire the artwork, and it's really incredible. They actually did an exhibition, I believe, in Tokyo about a decade ago that showed the Cultacept card artwork as though it was an actual art gallery. I would have loved to have gone to that.
Do you have a favorite card design?
My favorite card overall, and artwork as well, is a card called Jack-O-Lantern in Cultacept Saga. It's just neat all the way around. It has a very Tim Burton-esque kind of a feel to it, and the creature's abilities themselves are very appealing to me as well.
I'm a big fan of Cornfolk. When I saw that, I immediately thought, okay, I got to put that in my deck.
Yeah, I feel and have felt for a long time that they should delve deeper into the folk creatures. I mean, there's a Spud Folk, there's a Wood Folk, there's a Merfolk. I feel like they could really have some fun with that.
Do you have any suggestions or strategies for people playing the game? What are some of the key concepts players need to wrap their head around in order to succeed and have fun?
I would say at first, keep it simple. Try to get your cards to work together, and the starter books do work fairly well on their own initially. A friend of mine in the chat likes to say that people get a case of the ooh shiny whenever they get a new card because the card may have great abilities, but it may not work with the book that you are using at the moment. So try to keep it basic and then sort of gradually expand from there and experiment a little bit. It helps keep you from getting into trouble and not having a good time.
Is there any must-have card?
I would say the must-have card is probably Mad Harlequin, which is a card that has a boost feature that only affects your own creatures. Because it doesn't have any land prerequisites or anything like that, you can include it in just about any book and it will add to that.
This is a mostly Nintendo-focused podcast, so I got to talk about them a bit. I think most Nintendo fans were likely introduced to Cultacept through Super Smash Bros. Smash for Wii U actually had a Cultacept song, and there are Cultacept spirits in Smash Ultimate. What are your thoughts on Cultacept's representation in Smash?
We've actually, in our Discord chat, have gotten a lot of visitors who were introduced to Cultacept through that. And they were amazed to discover that Golligan, who is a long-running character in the series, was actually part of a game series that's over 20 years old now.
How did you think it even got into Smash in the first place? Because they only used a very few third-party characters, but suddenly Cultacept was also in there.
I feel like because Nintendo has been the publisher of Cultacept since 2012, I think it made a natural fit and made for an interesting additional element in Smash Brothers.
If you could have one character from Cultacept become a playable fighter in Smash, who would you pick?
A toss-up between Zenith or Golligan, I think. Being able to attack with a living staff would be pretty entertaining.
The last Cultacept game came out 6 years ago, and we're in the middle of the longest gap between games. What are your thoughts on the future of the franchise? Do you think we will see a Cultacept game on the Switch?
I think that's the most likely platform for the next game. I do feel like this gap is probably due in large part to the COVID pandemic. I know that has delayed a great many franchises in video gaming. But at the same time, I also know that Cultacept is Omayasoft's main IP. And so I would be very surprised if we went more than another year or so without seeing a new one in Japan, that is. Whether we see it here in the West is anybody's guess.
Let's talk about your site, Cultacept Central. What inspired you to create an English resource for the series?
Okay, well, back in 2008, when Codicept Saga came out here, there was actually, at the time, a CodiceptSaga.com that was not an official site for the game. A friend of mine named Jason had started that site, and myself and a few other Codicept regulars at the time were going to help him expand that into the community resource. Well, as we were just getting started to do that, Jason just kind of vanished. And we never did find out what happened to him. CodiceptSaga.com stayed up for probably about 7 years afterwards, and then that disappeared as well. But anyway, when I realized that that wasn't going to happen on CodiceptSaga.com, I had already started Codicept Central as a place to display the card list and the map list for Codicept Saga, and some card combos and that sort of thing. So I took that opportunity to just expand it and make it a gathering place for Codicept players, not just in the West, but anywhere in the world. And it's just kind of blossomed and grown from there. And here we are 14 years later.
Wonderful. So Andy, man, thanks for joining me today. Where can people find you and Codicept Central?
Okay, CodiceptCentral.com is, of course, available online. You can get to our Discord chat and our forum from the website. We're also on Twitter and Facebook, and the links for those are there as well. Codicept Revolt still has a very thriving online game. There's regulars in our Discord chat constantly making matches and playing them, and I couldn't be happier about that, because here it is 5 years after Codicept Revolt came to the West, and people are still playing it. We even still play Codicept Saga now and then. Interestingly, it never had a server. It was Codicept Saga was player-to-player networking, so it's still up and playable.
Excellent. And I'll put the links to everything in the podcast description. Andy Mann, once again, thanks for joining me.
You're very welcome. Thank you for having me.
Once again, thanks to Andy Mann for chatting Codicept with me. Be sure to check out Codicept Central. The links are in the description. A few months ago, I had an entire episode dedicated to Kirby. And last episode, I talked about Tilt and Tumble. You'd think that would be enough Kirby for 1 year, but honestly, not nearly enough. A few months ago, Kirby 64 was added to the Nintendo Switch Online service, and I had to give this game another whirl. I played it upon release and really enjoyed it. I remember it not getting the best reviews because, well, like most Kirby games, it's short and easy. And while Mario and Zelda made earth-shattering leaps into 3D, Kirby, not so much. He is technically 3D, so that's at least one baby step forward. Kirby 64, the Crystal Shards, is the last of the Shimomura-directed Kirby titles, aka the Dark Matter Trilogy. It all comes together here, at least sort of. It's not like there are any revelations or mysteries solved. You just fight Dark Matter again. But this time he's gone for good. I talked about Kirby's Dream Land 3, the second title in the trilogy, a couple of episodes ago. Kirby 64 definitely feels like a sequel to that game and not so much Superstar. Another brief refresher, Sakurai, the creator of Kirby, directed Kirby's Dream Land, Adventure, and Superstar. However, the mysterious Shinichi Shimomura directed several other Kirby titles in the 90s. Dream Land 2, 3, and Kirby 64. Both these trilogies are platformers starring Kirby, but play quite differently. Sakurai's games are faster-paced and action-oriented, and more experimental overall. Shimomura titles revolve more around a slower pace and puzzle-solving, plus a heavy focus on combining Kirby's powers with other elements. Most would consider the Sakurai games to be the superior titles. I mean, everyone talks about Kirby Superstar, and no one but me and other Kirby nerds talk about Dream Land 3. But the Shimomura titles are still very fun, and Kirby 64 is easily the best one. Released in Japan in 2000, it was Kirby's one and only game on the N64. Most N64 gamers likely knew Kirby from Smash first, and considering how fun he was to play in that game, a lot of people were looking forward to Kirby's first adventure on the console, myself included. I definitely remember highly anticipating Kirby 64. I got it pretty close to launch, so I was all up in the Kirby 64 zeitgeist. I feel among Kirby fans, it's maybe somewhere in the middle of the pack. You've got the classic games like Adventure and Superstar, then some really revered modern titles like Return to Dream Land and Robobot. But I don't think Kirby 64 is many people's favorite Kirby title. But that's okay, because there's still a ton of things to love about it. For one, it probably has the best gimmick of any Kirby title, the dual copy abilities. This isn't technically new, as the other Shimomura titles also centered around this idea. In Dream Land 2 and 3, you paired a power-up with an animal friend. A well-executed idea, but it finally saw its potential with this title. In the HUD, you have two slots for power-ups. You swallow an enemy, one slot is filled, and you can use the power-up freely. However, you can also toss your power-up at another enemy, and then it combines into a star that you can suck up. Now you've got your dual copy abilities. It's not two separate maneuvers, but instead a combined super attack. You mix the cutter with fire, and you now wield a huge flaming greatsword, something straight out of Elden Ring. Ice and Spark turn you into a fridge where you can throw food at enemies or use it to heal up. You can even double up the same ability. Bomb lets you, yeah, toss a bomb out, but two bombs? You now shoot a flurry of missiles out of your mouth. There are 7 normal abilities, so according to my calculations, 49 total copy abilities. This may technically be the most out of any Kirby game. And these are not just straight upgrades like in Forgotten Land. Many are completely different in their functionality. Double Fire turns you into a flaming bird that dashes across the map, but you become vulnerable after it's over, so you need to be aware of where you are going to land. Fire Needle turns you into a bow, and you need to time and angle your shots. Fire Electricity has Kirby rub some metallic sheet on his head, then he catches on fire and frantically runs around. Honestly, I can have a lot of fun just naming the abilities. They're so goofy, but also very fun to use. As a kid, I would pick a copy combo and try to clear the level with only that ability. Could you beat a lava stage as a fridge? I did. Kirby is a great series for self-imposed challenges because they're so easy, so anything to spice up the normal gameplay is appreciated. And the good thing is that you can pretty much clear any stage with any ability. There are some ability-based puzzles, but they are completely optional. Okay, top 3 combos. Number 1, Bomb Cutter. You get a bomb shuriken that instantly attaches to your opponent when you throw it. And by instant, I mean instant. It just goes whoosh, and it attaches to an enemy in a half second. It explodes, which pretty much eliminates any enemy in the game. This is the closest ninja-esque ability Kirby has at his disposal. Number 2, Spark and Cutter gives you a double lightsaber just like Darth Maul. But of course, it's yellow and not red. Kirby's not evil. This ability has a pretty wide range, and you do a cool spin attack. I cleared many a level solely with this ability back in the day. Number 3, Bomb and Fire turns you into a living firework. Kirby just explodes over and over again, destroying everything in his path. Only Kirby is brave enough to repeatedly blow himself up to save the galaxy. Those are probably my 3 favorite to use in the game, but pretty much every single combo has some merit, even the weaker joke ones. Alright, you've got these amazing powers, but where do you use them? Well, like in all Kirby games, you use them in 2D platformer levels that are mostly pretty flat with the occasional fun gimmick. HAL was still 22 years away from making a real 3D Kirby game, so instead they gave us this 2.5D platformer. Even though you're still just going from left to right, HAL does a great job in making it at least feel 3D. There are creative camera angles, changes in perspective, and it often feels cinematic in a way. As a kid, I never really thought of it as a 2D platformer like Super Mario World, but in reality, it is much closer to that title than, say, Super Mario 64. Compared to Dream Land 3, the levels are less maze-like. They have fewer secret areas or doors to find. It's still mostly straightforward, and you can easily visit every part of the level your first go-around. This makes 64 a bit closer to the Sakurai titles, but it's not nearly as kinetic and frantic as Superstar. Shimomura loves his collectibles and secrets hidden in levels, so it's no wonder that this idea reappears here. Kirby is searching for the titular Crystal Shards, blue crystal shards hidden throughout the level. Most stages have 3, and bosses give you one after defeat. You'll probably find all in the first world with minimal effort, but then they become much more hidden and cumbersome. Some are hidden behind ability gates like in past games. But this time, some might require a dual copy ability, which may not even be found in the level. One crystal shard is hanging in a cage that requires a spark cutter combo, but you can't get that combo in the level. You have to get it from another stage and bring it in here without losing it. Mario also has a few of these puzzles, but it's more frequent in this game. That ties in with the self-imposed challenge idea. How long can you survive with this power-up combo? Because it could easily get knocked out of you. Are the shards worth getting? They certainly add to the replay value. The campaign is about 5 hours long, but you could probably double that if you go for 100%. I would say the reward is certainly worth it. You get the true ending and an incredibly memorable and freaky final boss battle. Did you think the final boss of Forgotten Land was crazy? That's kindergarten compared to Kirby 64's final boss. I have a disturbingly long backlog, so I won't go for 100% again, but it's always there for me just in case I get the urge. Like most Kirby games, 64 has a few sub-games. Weirdly, they are hidden in the options menu. They didn't have enough room for them on the main menu? These are more akin to Mario Party minigames than the bite-sized games of Superstar or the more robust sub-games of the later Kirby titles. You can, however, play all of them with four players, keeping in with the multiplayer-heavy focus of the N64. There's only three games, but all of them are great. One has you catching falling fruit, and you can push others out of the way. You have to carefully time your shove to nab the fruit. The game is so simple, but it can get intense as everyone is bumping and swapping positions. The second one is a hopscotch race where you are going down to the finish line. A is two spaces and B is one space. There are hazards like puddles, frogs, and traps that you need to watch out for, so you need to tactically jump either one or two spaces. It's a lot more fun than it sounds, and on higher difficulties, it can get surprisingly tough. The best one, though, the masterpiece, is Checkerboard Chase. I say this with zero irony, this is one of the best minigames ever. You're on a big board made of squares, and you can shoot out a beam that makes all the blocks ahead of you turn into a color and then drop. Your goal is to make everyone drop off the board and bring their lives to zero. Keep in mind, everyone also has this power, so you are just seeing beams of color dart across the board. You have to tactically line up your shot, bait other players, and be aware when the blocks respawn, all while dodging these death beams. It's incredibly exciting, and I've spent hours just playing this one minigame. On intense difficulty, the computer gets insane, but that only makes me want to get better. It shines with multiple people, though, so just invite your friends over to play Checkerboard Chase. I promise they'll say yes. I badly wish this was some sort of esport. It takes way more skill than Dota, that's a fact. I haven't really touched on the graphics and sound. It's visually pretty serviceable. Kirby is as round as he could have been on the N64, and the game is filled with bright geometric shapes, so it's easy to parse everything. The NSO port looks quite nice. I know some of the N64 NSO games have had graphical glitches, but I had no problems with Kirby. Though there actually was a game-breaking glitch where Kirby would freeze if he got hit underwater by a Gordo. I'm pretty sure it was fixed, but I certainly experienced it. Not fun, I had to abuse some safe states to get past that. Oh, the music? Great. Planet Popstar? Again, zero irony, one of the best video game songs ever. It took forever to get this song into Smash, but it finally made its way in a few years ago. I dare you to listen to this music and not immediately want to play the game. So, 22 years later, Kirby 64 still holds up. It's definitely a bit slower than I remembered, but the dual copy abilities is the best Kirby gimmick. Discovering and experimenting with them is the best part of the game, and I think people playing it for the first time would be impressed at how wacky they are. I'd absolutely recommend it to any NSO subscriber out there. I mean, you're paying for the service. Might as well get a good Kirby game out of it. How about some slightly newer games? I'm married, but honestly, I don't play so many games with my wife. She plays games very sporadically and can go months or years without playing one if nothing catches her eye. Also, when I'm with her, hey, let's spend some time actually looking at each other. However, we did recently get into not one, but two games. One is Overcooked. Can you guess the second one? Congrats, you're right, it's Overcooked 2. Overcooked was developed by UK team Ghost Town Games and published by Teen 17, the company behind the Worms franchise. Overcooked 2 is also co-developed by them as well. It's a multiplayer-focused co-op cooking sim where you prepare dishes to serve customers. The game revolves around efficiently managing your tasks while also dealing with a variety of obstacles ranging from speeding vehicles to earthquakes. If you've ever hopped into the eShop, you've likely seen it on sale. It's probably on sale more often than not. When my wife and I started dating, I want to say I bought Overcooked specifically to play with her. We played a couple of maps and had fun, but dropped it after maybe one or two gameplay sessions. Flash forward a few years, and now we're married. For whatever reason, she said, "Let's play Overcooked again recently." I get it. I often have the feeling of suddenly wanting to play a random game out of the blue. Yesterday, I was thinking, should I go back and 100% part-time UFO? We picked up Overcooked again and actually cleared the game. After that, we did the DLC levels, and she even made me buy Overcooked 2 so we could continue our cooking journey. Switch is filled with tons of multiplayer, family-friendly, couch co-op games, and Overcooked is clearly one of the more popular ones. It's often at the top of the charts on the eShop, and I've seen countless stories online of other couples playing these games. It really is an excellent game for couples. You've got teamwork, you share some laughs, it's easy mechanically, and requires a lot of strategy and thinking. But there are some intense moments, and maybe some blame to go around if you fail. Sometimes it was my fault, sometimes it was her fault, but you've got to look past that, and most importantly, stay calm. Like I said earlier, it's technically a cooking sim, but a very silly one. You grab ingredients, prepare them, then put them on a dish to serve to customers. Each level has the same agenda, but there are some slight differences in how you prepare certain dishes. You need to grill hamburger meat in a skillet, but soup requires a pot. Later on, you get to make pizza where you put all the raw ingredients into an oven, and burritos where you need to both grill meat and cook rice. The second game takes this concept way beyond this as it introduces mixers to make pancake batter or smoothies and even steam baskets to cook Chinese dumplings. Mechanically, all food preparation is the same. You take the ingredient and put it in something else, but you still need to be aware of each tool's gimmick. It's very smart to not make the dishes too different from each other. You are still pressing the same buttons from level 1 to the final boss, so it never feels like you are constantly needing to master completely new skills to succeed. It's all about executing on what you know. The cooking part is charming, but the real meat, that's the food pun, of the game comes from the level's obstacles. The game excels in introducing a gimmick and then building upon it in fun ways. One level has you on an iceberg. Later on, you've got to cross several floating icebergs to reach different parts of the stage. There's a stage with two trucks you need to go back and forth between, but a few stages later, three, count them, three trucks. Entering a new level is always exciting because the gimmick isn't immediately apparent at first. Okay, everything's going fine, you're cooking burgers. Oh no, an earthquake split the kitchen in two. Now one person is on top, one person's on the bottom. Trying to quickly adjust to the chaos is a fun part of the game as you and your co-op buddy are just shouting orders at each other. Though on the harder stages, it's less about adjusting to the situation and more about making an efficient plan. Each stage has 3 stars to earn based on your score. If you get 1 star, you clear the stage, but that doesn't mean you can just progress to the next one. In Overcooked 1 especially, there is a high degree of level gating. You might have earned 10 stars total, but the next level requires 15 stars to unlock. That means you've got to go back and replay some old levels and get better scores to nab those stars. This is a pretty interesting mechanic to put in what seems like a party game on the surface, but it still demands your attention and wants you to get better at it. It would have been a safer decision just to automatically unlock the next level as long as you get 1 star, but it also means that players would likely never improve and might get bored with the game if it was too mindless. The game forcing you to go back and get better scores in past levels may seem frustrating at first, but you undoubtedly get better at the game. There were levels where I thought 3 stars would be impossible, but after understanding the stage a bit more, and of course, with the efforts of my wonderful wife, we managed to easily hit the highest ranking. Sometimes I would clear a level and dread coming back to it, only to find out that, oh, it's not so scary once you've played it a few times. The level gates for the first game can be pretty harsh, especially when unlocking those last levels. I suspect there was some negative feedback towards this decision, as Overcooked 2 seems much more lighter on the star requirements. We didn't need to replay a level until nearly the end of the game. though since we went into Overcooked 2 right after 1, we were demolishing those early stages. It was like Michael Jordan playing street ball at the local park. The final boss on the first game is also very memorable and a great challenge. We tried it a few times and barely got halfway through. I thought there's no way we're going to clear it. Each try takes about 10 minutes, so that definitely saps a bit of your soul after each defeat. We started to watch videos, planned out what we were going to do at each part of the boss battle, and we managed to clear it with about 10 seconds left on the clock. A great victory, a great feeling. We actually haven't cleared the second game yet, though we are nearing the finale. The second game is fundamentally the same as the first, but it does introduce a new mechanic, throwing. This lets you hurl ingredients at each other or even into cooking tools. So if you have a skillet on the stove and toss some meat in there, it will start cooking it. Both games have a light physics system, but the throwing is pretty stiff. You still need to think about positioning and range, though. This new mechanic isn't that game-changing, but a lot of levels are built around it, so it at least feels like somewhat of a departure from the first game. There are quite a few quirky obstacles in Overcooked 2, my favorite being the magic portals. But it definitely feels like an Overcooked 1.5 situation, which isn't a bad thing. If you want more Overcooked levels, here they are. It does have a much improved UI though, which is really helpful. Both Overcooked games are very solid co-op titles. On the surface, it seems like a goofy physics game with a lot of chaos happening around you, but the game excels at planning and execution. It supports 4 players, but I have to think it's likely better as a 2-player title because each person really needs to be in lockstep with the other. 4 people almost seems like too easy, or maybe even too frustrating, due to the lack of room to move around, but maybe some people would prefer that. Which one to pick up? Both are almost the same price. I feel like Overcooked 1 demands a bit more of the player, but 2 has a bit more variety. The first game only has a handful of recipes that can get boring after a while. I get it, burgers. The second game has some cool ones like sushi and cake. If you only get one, I think you can just jump straight into Overcooked 2, and then if you liked that game, pick up Overcooked 1. Both games are mechanically the same, and the level quality is high in both titles, so it doesn't feel like a regression if you played the series backwards. The tough thing about a lot of co-op titles on the Switch is hitting the right audience. Is it for little kids? Is it for couples? Is it for the whole family? I think Overcooked is interesting enough to appeal to everyone, though it could be a bit frustrating for very young children. Even for adults, some stages require a bit of trial and error, so it can definitely feel like you're hitting a brick wall until you understand how to master the stage. It's definitely not a Mario Party minigame, but I think that anyone could pick up, play, and really enjoy either Overcooked game. It doesn't look like a third one is on the way, but if Ghost Town Games makes another co-op-focused title in the future, I'll definitely keep an eye on it. Maybe I'll even buy it at full price. That's it for games. Now for the news. We've been pretty news-heavy these past few episodes with the Summer Games Fest and the Nintendo Directs. The past few weeks have been somewhat slower, but there's still enough to talk about. Kirby's getting a brand new game, Kirby's Dream Buffet, or Kirby's Gourmet Fest in Japanese. Developed by HAL, it's a 4-player competitive game where you and other Kirbys roll around and eat strawberries. The person who eats the most strawberries at the end of the race wins. It's a mix of Kirby's Tilt and Tumble, Gourmet Race from Superstar, and Fall Guys. Hey, did I not just talk about Kirby's Tilt and Tumble last episode? This almost looks like a spiritual sequel. Though, is Tilt and Tumble a spiritual sequel to Pinball Land? Either way, Kirby is now a ball and life is good. Like Tilt and Tumble, it seems to have a heavier focus on clearing obstacles instead of fighting enemies, though you do get some special power-ups to mess with your foes. I like the idea that it's not just a straight-up race, and there's another factor at play with the strawberries. It should help even the playing field. Kirby spin-offs can be pretty hit and miss, but this one looks way more interesting than the other Switch spin-offs like Super Kirby Clash and Kirby Fighters 2. It has a strange release date of summer 2022. Are we not in summer now? There's only about 6 weeks or so left of summer. Seems weird to completely hold back the date. No price either, though I can see it being a budget $20 title like Kirby Fighters 2. Bayonetta 3 also got a new trailer and a launch date, October 28th. This is pretty much in line with my expectations. Bayonetta is a very Halloween-y type of game. It showed off some new characters, including the playable Viola, who has a katana. Hey, I'm sold. Bayonetta 1 is also getting a limited physical edition. Bayonetta is yet another one of those franchises I've never touched. I keep wanting to check out the past games, of course, but they never go on sale on the Switch. Though maybe 3 will be a good entry point. I know a lot of people love the story, but it looks like a title that can stand on its own with just the gameplay. We've waited a long, long, long time for this game, and it'll be here before you know it. Before Zelda, who would have guessed that? Nintendo finally announced new hardware. Yes, the Switch Pro is finally here. Oh wait, no, it's just a Splatoon-themed OLED launching on August 26th. So a few weeks before Splatoon 3. It features green and purple gradient Joy-Cons with Splatoon iconography. The weird thing is that the back of the Joy-Cons are white. Not sure about that look, but hey, maybe some people like it. It reminds me of the translucent blue N64 in Japan. In the West, it's all translucent, but the Japanese version has half blue, half white. Why? I don't know. The back of the Switch also has the Splatoon graffiti as well as the dock. So if you like Splatoon, it looks pretty nice. I still think the Animal Crossing Switch is the best unique model, but even that is a bit obsolete now thanks to the OLED. Though the Animal Crossing Joy-Cons still look great. I don't want to hit the rumor buzzer or anything, but there is still a lot of hubbub about a possible Switch Pro or maybe even a Switch 2 coming soon. Though Pro seems far more likely. Codenamed the Drake, it's rumored to use updated NVIDIA hardware. There have been some folks who have been saying that a Splatoon OLED would be announced, and then soon an announcement of an upgraded Switch. The Splatoon Switch did happen, but is this just an easy guess or is something truly on the horizon? We'll see. I think most people were shocked by the OLED announcement last year. So many people were definitively stating that an upgraded Switch with new hardware was going to hit last year, but instead we just got a screen revision. I don't think having a new 3DS-style upgrade for the Switch this year is completely out of the question, though. Switch Pro this year and then Switch 2 in 2024 seems completely probable. Switch hardware sales are slowing down compared to last year, so Nintendo giving people some reason to buy a new one in the twilight years of the system makes perfect sense. Will I buy one? If it's an actual hardware upgrade, absolutely. The 3DS to new 3DS definitely felt like a big jump in terms of power and just loading games quicker. But I just got an OLED for Christmas, so another Switch after less than a year does seem a bit too much. This new Switch could come out early next year before Zelda, though I can see Nintendo wanting to get it out for the holiday push. And OLED isn't the only thing Splatoon is getting. There will also be a nationwide quiz for Japan on July 23rd and 24th. Both days will have two sessions of live quizzes, and people can compete to show off their knowledge of Splatoon. You don't get any reward, but there are rankings, so your name might appear on the leaderboard. Not sure if I'm going to throw my hat in the ring, but I like to at least see what questions they ask. Quickly, type the name of all the rollers. Pokemon Puzzle League is now available on the North American Nintendo 64 Nintendo Switch app. Japan got a twofer, Custom Robo and Custom Robo V2. All these games are region exclusives. Pokemon Puzzle League never came out in Japan despite being developed here. It's a game from Nintendo Software Technology, but the boys and girls living just a few kilometers from their office couldn't get their hands on it. Ironically, the Intelligent Systems developed Pokemon Puzzle Challenge for GBC did come out in Japan. Custom Robo, of course, famously never hit the States until the GameCube version. I actually own V2, but I have never opened it, so I'll just wait for the Switch version. I have fond memories of Puzzle League, but it is a very challenging game, so let's see if my skills have improved these 20-odd years later. I think Pokemon Puzzle League and at least Custom Robo V2 will definitely pop up on the podcast again in the future. New games are also coming out. Valkyrie Elysium is hitting PS4 and PS5 on September 29th. Also announced, the PSP game Valkyrie Profile Lineth is coming to those platforms as well. I have never touched this franchise, sorry to say, but it always did look interesting visually. The gameplay of this new version isn't really grabbing my attention, but maybe it will be a sleeper hit. It's one of the many, many, many games Square is putting out in this last half of the year. No Switch version yet, seems pretty odd to ignore it. The game doesn't look graphically earth-shattering, so maybe we will see it on the handheld next year. I think the Switch could at least run a PSP game. A game that is coming to the Switch, though, is Frogun. It is pretty much every platform on August 2nd. I talked about this a few episodes ago, but it's a 3D platformer where your gun is a frog, though it looks more akin to a hookshot than an actual gun. The game has a very striking and nostalgic 3D art style. Think Mega Man Legends. I have a lot on my plate already, but if you can't make room for a game with a frog gun, what are you even doing? This year had a lot of frog games showcased, and I ran into a Kickstarter of another one recently. Bring on the Age of the Frogs. Zombies had their time, now it's the frog's turn. Okay, so Yuji Naka, acclaimed game developer and producer. The father of Sonic the Hedgehog, you could say. The former head of Sonic Team, during its heyday no less. Anyone who is a fan of retro games or Japanese games has certainly touched a title he's worked on. Phantasy Star Online, need I say more? He's been making headlines recently due to his unfiltered tweets and recent controversies with Square Enix and Arzest. Now, while Naka has a legendary list of achievements to his name, he's also legendarily difficult to work with. There are many, many, many anecdotes regarding his stubbornness and innate ability to turn off everyone working with him. His most recent title is the much-maligned Balan Wonderworld, a game that was derided so much that it became a meme. Think Morbius before Morbius. A year has passed since that game flopped, but recently Yuji Naka has aired out his grievances on Twitter, along with revealing just random information about his development history with Sega. I can't run down every little tidbit here since there's so much of it, but let's look at the juicier parts. A few months ago, he was very vocal against Square Enix regarding his removal from Balan and accused them of pushing it out too early. He also noted that co-developer Arzest didn't care about games, and Naka has a poor relationship with its vice president, Naoto Oshima, who, by the way, is the co-creator of Sonic the Hedgehog. Perhaps the most ridiculous event of the saga is a tweet Naka put out recently celebrating Knight's anniversary. In the photo of the original launch, he blacked out Oshima. As in, he literally used the black marker tool on a smartphone and blurred him out. You're probably thinking he's exaggerating, right? I assure you, I am not. Please Google this. Now, this is obviously a very silly and immature thing to do as a grown man. Why not find any other picture of Knight's? He obviously wants people to know that he is extremely dissatisfied with Oshima, Arzest, Balan, and everything else. Not sure how far back the blood feud with Oshima goes, but Naka has no problem dragging this out into the public. Naka, historically, has a poor reputation when it comes to working with and cooperating with others. There are so many anecdotes of him just ignoring feedback, getting into petty arguments with coworkers, and just being incredibly frustrating to work with. So it's kind of hard to side with him considering his well-documented past. Is he just straight up lying? It's incredibly possible, which brings me to the next part of the saga, Naka revealing information about past Sega games. Sonic Extreme was going to be a Sega Saturn title developed by Sega Technology Institute, which mostly had an American staff. Famously, Sonic did not have an original outing on Sega's final 2D platform. There's so much out there already about the strife between the development team and Sega and how this game never came to light, but one element of the story is that STI wanted to use the Knights engine and Naka at the time said no. A few days ago, Naka tweeted out that no one even asked to use the Knights engine, and even if they did, it would be impossible to use with other games. This statement is the exact opposite of what developers at STI have said about Extreme. I'm more inclined to believe somebody who actually worked on the game opposed to Naka. I just think Naka randomly tweeting out info and lies about old games is very amusing, but I wouldn't carve his statements in stone just yet. Hey, there's more Kirby news. A new Kirby Cafe in Nagoya is going to open up September 15th. It looks pretty similar to the one that already exists in Tokyo and Fukuoka. I've been to the Tokyo one and had a great time. I'll certainly feature it on a future episode of the podcast. Kirby is also getting a character encyclopedia in Japan on September 28th. It features over 1,000 characters from Kirby. I thought there's no way that there's 1,000 Kirby characters, but looking at the Kirby Wiki, it has 1,099 characters, a number I certainly didn't expect. Who's your favorite Kirby character? Me? I think I'll go with Kirby. Now for the Japanese gaming phrase of the week. This week's phrase is Jujiki. Jujiki. It literally translates to cross key. Do you have an idea what this is? The English phrase is actually D-pad, the button that helps you control where a character moves. Juji in Japanese is cross, and the Ju kanji does look like a cross, so it does make sense, even though it's pretty different from the English phrase. The Japanese phrase is mostly based on its appearance, while the English one is all about its functionality. I mean, it doesn't look like a D now, does it? What's the best Jujiki ever? Sega Saturn? Super Nintendo? Once more, Jujiki. Now for the Japanese tweet of the week. It's not from Yuji Naka. I picked one from at Kmot and Kirby. It's fan art of a Kirby slash Dango crossover with different Dango flavored Kirby. You've got Mitarashi, Sanshoku, and On Styles. I'm more of a Mitarashi type of person. I mean, that's the default Dango, right? As always, the tweet is in the description. Time's up. Thanks as always for listening. Be sure to like and subscribe to this podcast on your favorite app. The podcast is also available on YouTube, so like and subscribe there as well. Also, if you go to my official website, tokyogamelife.com, you can see what platforms it's available on. I'm on Twitter, Instagram, and TikTok. Just search for Tokyo Game Life and find the links in the podcast description. If you like the podcast, be sure to share it with your friends and on social media. If there's anything you want me to talk about or cover, don't be shy, just message me on Twitter. The next episode will be Sunday, July 31st. See you next time. Matane!